The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today grew up surrounded by the purity movement within evangelical America in the 1990s and early 2000s. Purity rings and pledges and constant messages of sexual abstinence throughout puberty and adolescence was a constant for Linda K. Klein, creating an unhealthy atmosphere of anxiety, stress, and sexual shame. During her adolescence, the importance of being pure was so ingrained, she would take pregnancy tests even though she was still a virgin. She broke up with her first love because she believed it would please God and suffered through intense abdominal pain, thinking it was some failure of spirit rather than the Crohn's disease that was ravaging her body. Eventually, her beliefs changed and she began questioning the sexual shame she'd been feeling both as an adolescent and as an adult. She began speaking with her teenage friends from her church and found they were also trying to cope with the same shaming issues as her. Her search widened to other similar faith communities around the country, and she found remarkably similar stories from young women, stories of sexual and gender-based anxiety, fear, even PTSD-like experiences in adulthood, and how many of these women were working to reclaim a healthier life today. Linda K. Klein is the founder of Break Free Together and the author of Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. It's published by Touchstone. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Linda K. Klein, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, Pure, tells your own story of how you psychologically recovered from the sexual and gender-based shaming you experienced growing up in an evangelical Christian church. And that's a remarkable story in and of itself. The more remarkable story is that afterwards you did decades worth of interviews with nearly all of your teenage peers who had the same experience. And what was interesting is your story was the rule rather than the exception. How surprising was that?
It was absolutely shocking to me. I was really struggling in my early 20s because I thought I was the only one. I felt like I was alone. And there was something terribly wrong with me that was going to prevent me from ever being healthy or having a healthy relationship. And, you know, I had just left the evangelical church and had rejected the sexual shaming that I had been raised with, you know, still a Christian, but no longer a part of the evangelical community. And I was under the impression that I was now going to be free from sexual shame, that I had really chosen to no longer allow to reign over my life, and I had stepped out of the community that was delivering the shaming messages. And yet that's when I discovered just how deep this experience of having been raised, you know, learning about sexuality via shame had gone inside of me. And as I said, you know, now I was in a secular community, so I was experiencing deep sexual shame and fear and anxiety that was sometimes manifesting physically in ways that mimic classic PTSD. And my secular peers, you know, certainly weren't experiencing that. And it wasn't until I started calling up my girlfriends from back home in my evangelical Christian church and telling them what was happening to me. And then, you know, listening with my jaw dropped to the floor as they told me very similar stories from their own lives, that I started to understand that it wasn't just me, that I wasn't the problem, that the problem was what we were taught.
In many ways, it was like an indoctrination.
Yes. I mean, you know, if we can talk a little bit of brain research for a minute, I'm not a brain researcher, but I've become very interested in brain research because of what I learned. You know, so there's a very common idiom in neurobiology called Hebb's axiom that says neurons that fire together wire together. What that means is basically if you fire a particular neurocircuit at the same time as another neurocircuit often enough, eventually firing one will automatically fire the others, and that creates what some researchers call a brain trap. And I believe that that's exactly what happened to me and to girls who are raised in this purity movement in the evangelical church, though certainly not exclusive to the evangelical church. We developed a sex shame brain trap because we were, you know, taught about sex and about sexuality and about our body via this shaming experience and shaming messaging so often that, you know, as we become older, our sexual thoughts, feelings, experiences, other people's sexual thoughts and feelings and behaviors toward us, all of these things trigger shame because we have this sex shame brain trap internally.
Of course, a big part of this purity culture is for women is to save your virginity until you've met the man that you love and that you are, in fact, married. But that doesn't turn off once the marriage begins, does it?
No.
The shaming.
It's quite sad because there's this equation that's taught to us in purity culture, which is if you're utterly and absolutely non-sexual before marriage, then you will have a blissful sexual relationship after marriage. And it's an if A, then B, right? It's this kind of equation. But the reality is if you spend your entire life internalizing sexual shame and pushing down your sexual feelings and training yourself not to have sexual thoughts, right? It doesn't suddenly magically turn into sexual, bliss in marriage. You know, on the contrary, you really can experience some blockages to that bliss. And yet, when you go and tell somebody, we're having struggles in our marriage, very often they'll ask you, well, then what did you do before marriage? Because if A, then B. So if you're not experiencing bliss now, you must have done something wrong then.
Yeah, again, it goes back to shaming it once again, right from the from the get-go. Well, I'm sure there are listeners that are very familiar with purity culture, but there's probably other listeners who've rarely, if ever, heard this terminology. What is purity culture?
Purity culture is really, I would say, not exclusive to the evangelical Christian church. But, I'll talk about it in the evangelical manifestation, which is a culture where gender expectations are very stark and sharp, but so too are sexual expectations. And girls and women are deemed impure based on their own sexual thoughts and feelings and behaviors, and also based on the sexual thoughts and feelings and behaviors of men in the community toward them that they are said to have inspired by the way that they walk or talk or dress or any number of things about them, which, of course, can result in a deep anxiety that does not go away over the course of your life. But the reason I say it's not exclusive to evangelical Christianity is because, really this idea of sexual purity is not new. We really see how this evangelical community has gone very, very deep with this messaging, with this toxic messaging that impacts people in a very damaging way. But really, this messaging is part of our culture at large, and we're all taking in unhealthy amounts of sexual shame as a result.
Yeah, abstinence-only sex education, for example.
Right.
One of the central teachings seems to be, to women at least, of this religious culture, is not to be, what you've referred to this over and over in the book, a stumbling block to men. Well, now, what does that mean?
So a stumbling block in the Bible is used many times to refer to a blockage that would prevent somebody on their pathway to God. Now, it's used many times in the Bible, and it's referenced in many different ways. But in the church, it's funny because I really only ever heard it growing up used in one way. I heard it exclusively used to reference girls and women who were stumbling blocks to men and boys' successful spiritual relationship because of their sexuality. So my friends and I were regularly pulled aside and told that we were stumbling blocks or that we were in danger of becoming stumbling blocks because our skirt was too short or our tank top straps were too thin or the way that we were talking to the boys was too flirtatious or whatever it was that was taking men and boys' their likelihood to be sexually tempted and encouraging it in such a way that was our fault, right? So we would be accused of being stumbling blocks.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I really, really just amazed me later as I went back years and years later and read all the references to stumbling blocks in the Bible is that that is completely non-biblical. That's never used in the Bible. Stumbling block is never used to refer to women and girls and to their bodies and to their sexual natures.
If I remember right, the one reference I think I come up with is the stumbling block if your eye roams, so to speak, for men towards women, it's better to take out that eye, typical biblical verbiage, but it was directed towards a man. But
yes.
How it shows up in at least these very patrimonial sort of cultures is it's really all directed towards women.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, so in that passage, it's the eye that is referred to as the stumbling block, right? So the lust, if the lust within you, if you're feeling lustful, it's better for you to get rid of the eye than to suffer the consequences. So, but it's quite different than what we are ultimately taught. No one has ever talked about, be careful because you have a stumbling block, which is your own lust. Instead, it becomes, you are a stumbling block because you are inspiring that lust, women and girls.
Yeah, and it's deeply ingrained patrimonial sort of behavior, right? They're cultural.
You hit it on the head. Yep. This is a deep cultural problem that is embedded into so many factions of our society, and certainly embedded deeply into our religion and to this particular religious group.
Another term which I had not really ever heard of, it's complementarianism. And this is also gets back to these patrimonial sex roles for gender, in which the man makes the decisions. The man is the head of the household. The man is the head of the house, which, in many cultures, that's the woman's role. And the woman is to support the man.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The complementarianism frame is that men are to be the hyper-masculine, supportive, loving leader, and women are to be the hyper-feminine, supportive, loving follower. And as long as women are always following and men are always leading, these two genders will complement one another, hence complementarianism. But if either strays, if a man isn't masculine enough in the traditional stereotypical definition of that word, or the women are, stepping up into leadership roles or whatever the case might be, the whole thing topples. It's really just a rebranding of patriarchy.
You're one of the things that was really struck me is you've written that in your experience within the evangelical church, that many of the sort of bedrock principles of church teachings are somewhat malleable, situational at times. But what you found is this teaching of women's purity seems ironclad. Does it just go back to the fact that this is a patrimonial culture?
Yeah, that's a really great observation. So basically, what I believe you're referring to is I referenced the work of a researcher, Donna Freitas, who had done some work where she had spoken with college students, evangelical college students, and she found that there was just a tremendous amount of variety among them. All the stereotypes about evangelicals, there were instances that they were proven to be untrue. People had differing political views, they had differing views on many different issues. But the one area in which there was tremendous consistency was around sexual purity. Everybody knew that sexual purity was of absolute and utter importance, and that is because of the purity movement. The purity movement that started in the early 1990s and quickly turned into a purity industry, in which people were surrounded by purity messaging via products like purity rings and purity pledges and purity curricula and purity balls and all kinds of things, purity-themed Bibles, really drove it into people's brains that this was so important, so much so that many, many people I've spoken with tell me that they had the impression that it was the most important thing about them and the most important thing about their expression of their Christianity. If they could be sexually pure, that meant that they were a Christian, and if they weren't, it meant that they potentially were not.
And of course, your own experience does follow that. Tell us a little bit about your own experience. You were so ingrained in staying pure, even though you're a virgin, you were taking pregnancy tests. Was that for like kissing?
Yeah, it's embarrassing, but the truth is that I was living in such a state of anxiety.
It was not embarrassing. I want to stop you right there. It was not embarrassing. It's very sad.
Yeah.
The misinformation and everything that was a part of you and your peers' life.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And these days I'm not embarrassed about it anymore because I understand that I wasn't alone. But at the time, I felt incredibly embarrassed and incredibly shameful. The idea that I was doing something so nonsensical, that I was a virgin, but after I had, sexual experimentation of any kind, I was filled with such a tremendous anxiety that it would be found out by the community I'd left but was still desperate to have approve of me, that I was, I couldn't quiet the anxiety until I went and took this pregnancy test that showed me the beautiful minus sign that said that I was safe and I could steady my breathing again. And I really did feel quite alone. And, you know, once I started doing the interviews, of course, which I, you know, started in my hometown in that first year of interviews and have now since done 12 years of interviews with people around the country raised in white American evangelical Christian churches as girls as I was, I've heard that story again and again. As it turns out, I was not the only one taking pregnancy tests, though I was not a virgin, or any number of the other experiences that I had. This was a remarkably, painfully common experience for many of us.
You broke up with a boyfriend because you believed it would please God. You consulted your other girls in your circle, and it was sort of jointly decided. And I can't remember, I may be conflating stories, but didn't somebody suggest the story of Gideon putting the fur outside and see if it gathered the dew to see if it would please God or not? I mean, these are the sort of things that girls are making these sort of life choices based on.
Yeah, and I think what you're really getting at there, that is a couple of stories you're talking about, but I'm glad you brought up a couple of stories, because what you're really getting at there is that there was so much ambiguity. Everybody had a different definition of what purity was, and your purity was determined by the perception of the community. If they considered you pure, you were pure. If they didn't, you weren't. And the community members all had differing, you know, definitions of purity. And if you were to actually ask a sexual question, you know, surely you would be deemed impure. If you were to express a, you know, I'm doing something, is this okay? You know, most definitely you're probably going to be deemed impure. So what that created was this sort of having to figure it all out on your own. You know, you were kind of guessing at what was okay and what was safe and what was, you know, what was sin. And you really were isolated, and then ultimately, you know, when people found out about something, you know, in the case that you're talking about the rabbit's foot, you know, there's a young woman who, you know, is looking for answers from God about whether what she's doing is okay or not, and she's putting out her rabbit's foot into the lawn and saying if it gathers dew in the morning, it's okay, and if it doesn't, it's not. You know, she's sort of looking for these mystical answers because she can't go to anyone else, her family or her community. And later when her family does discover, you know, what her sexual experimentation was, they say to her, you knew all along, you knew this was wrong. But how are we really supposed to know anything when we're in such a state of anxiety and isolation that we can't go to anybody?
My guest today is Linda K. Klein, the founder of Break Free Together and the author of Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. It's published by Touchstone. Well, this also brings up a point that goes beyond young men and women who are within this evangelical movement or within the purity movement itself. And that's the amount of misinformation, myths, and half-truths about sex education that exists in all young people. I think you point to several studies that we think this is such a sexualized generation that there doesn't need to be meaningful sex education. There's a lot of misbeliefs, you know, just crazy thinking about sex to begin with that you document in the book. So some of the people you interviewed, it's like they'd been in the purity movement, they found each other, they got married, they had no idea how to consummate the marriage.
That's exactly right. One of my interviewees told me something that I think is a great illustration of this. She said, I once read an entire book on masturbation, and I finished the book. This is a Christian book. I finished the book, and I thought, okay, masturbation is wrong. What is it exactly? You know, she read an entire book about it, and she did not know what masturbation was. And that's something that comes up a lot because, you know, the church talks about sex all the time. The evangelical church talks about sex all the time, you think. But the reality is that they never talk about sex. They only talk about shame. They talk about you, who you're expected to be, who you will be if you do not meet those expectations, you know, and what the consequences of your being that impure person will be. You know, so ultimately, you can talk about, you know, sex as a threat, you know, day in and day out, and still have people never really understand what sex is. And that happened to many of my interviewees. A number of my interviewees told me that they were in their 20s until they discovered actually what sex was, because it was so not talked about. And as you referenced, this is not that different from what's happening in society, where we have, young people who have a tremendous sexual vocabulary because they've heard all of these words. And so adults might think, oh, they're very sexually, you know, aware. But very often they have no idea what those words mean. They certainly haven't been talked to about how to make healthy sexual decisions or even healthy relationship decisions. You know, and all you really have to do is get into a meaningful conversation with a young person at any length, and you'll discover that.
Well, another, perhaps even a greater miscarriage of this society is how it also promotes the systemic mishandling of sexual abuse cases, rape, and sexual violence. I think this is probably one of the most disturbing parts of the book.
Yes, it's actually quite sad. So ultimately, in purity culture, we're teaching that girls are responsible for the sexual purity of everyone. You know, as I mentioned earlier, we're taught that men and boys are easily sexually tempted and that women and girls are meant to protect men and boys and protect themselves by wearing the right thing, by, you know, doing everything just right. And when we set that precedent, when we blame one gender for the thoughts and the feelings and the behaviors of another gender, what we're really doing is we're playing into rape culture, because later we see what happens. We see that when girls and women are violated, sexually violated, that we assess those violations using the rules that we have for sex, which is quite problematic because sexual violence is not sex, it is violence. But nonetheless, we're using those rules. So we're immediately saying, well, something happened in the sexual realm and girls and women are responsible for protecting themselves and others. So what did she do wrong? What was she wearing? Was she drinking? Was she out too late? How did she leave herself open to and susceptible to this sexual sphere, which, again, we mischaracterize as sexuality instead of as violence?
I was horrified by one family's reaction to a young woman's decision to tell her family that she was raped on campus. And the first remark out of their mouth was, "What were you wearing?"
She was horrified as well. Yeah, that's such a painful story. Just such a manifestation of exactly what we're talking about. You know, the father himself, who's a pastor, you know, eventually went back to her and said, "I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I hadn't done that." But when this is your training, that is your knee-jerk reaction.
Yes.
And that's a problem. You know, we should be training people to be having a knee-jerk reaction that is truly Christian. That is to say, Christ-like, that is loving, that is non-judgmental, not one that is shaming and judging.
And of course, in your own life and in the life of your peers, which where these interviews began, it was really the decision that sort of turned you against this culture was the fact that your youth pastor, the one that had generated your youth group and this group of people coming together, had eventually committed an act of sexual battery against one of the members of the group.
Yes, and not even just eventually, because when I found out that he had been convicted of child yes. enticement with the intent to have sexual contact with a 12-year-old girl in our youth group, I also found out that he had previously been moved along silently, quietly, from two other evangelical Christian institutions at which he had confessed to doing almost exactly the same thing after having been reported. And that was really when I started to differentiate my faith in God, which remains incredibly strong to this day, and my faith in Christianity from my faith in the institution of the church, you know, because I really started to see the potential for deep systemic harm and abuse in this institution.
My guest today is Linda K. Klein, the founder of Break Free Together and the author of Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. It's published by Touchstone, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, as you interview these women, you found this story that keeps coming to the fore time and time again. But what was really interesting was not their remembrances, but how they were living their life that day and the fact that there was real lasting damage apparent in their lives at the moment you're interviewing them. In some cases, this is the first time they ever talked about these issues, and they were just beginning to come to terms with what they'd been through.
That's just right. Yes, these are lifelong effects for many people. And if we don't have the opportunity to come into voice, to tell our stories, to question the things that we were raised with, to reflect on how they are impacting our lives, you know, they remain unquestioned and continue to have this subtle, presence in our lives, which at moments can be not very subtle at all. You know, at moments can erupt in ways that, as I said, you know, nightmares, anxiety, which can go so far as to panic attacks, fear, which can go so far as to paranoia. So really, it's very important for us to be able to create spaces for people to be able to do story exchange so that they can start to heal, so that this doesn't become a lifelong reality. And that's really what I did, you know, when I did these interviews. I essentially put myself through 12 years of narrative therapy where I repeated my story over and over again and then heard my story told back to me and the stories of others, you know, that really mirrored the sexual shame and fear and anxiety that I was experiencing. And that was healing for me. You know, it really helped me to differentiate, you know, myself from the problem in a way that allowed me to deal with the problem. And that's something that many of my interviewees said it did for them as well. They felt afterward that that first interview was the beginning of their own healing journey because they were given the space to reflect on these things, which we almost never really give people the space to reflect on. And they were given the gift of knowing that they weren't alone, which I told people. I would say you're the second person or the third person or the fourth person to tell me that story.
Yeah, and we're talking about impacts on their professional relationships, their professional careers, their interpersonal relationships, both friendships and intimate relationships. We're talking about major damage to their personal life.
Absolutely. So the organization that I created, Break Free Together, we are working on creating spaces for people to share stories so that they can start to heal. And one of the tools that we're working on is just creating a simple way for people to be able to find one another online with a hashtag. So the hashtag that we've come up with is Break Free Together, because I truly believe we don't break free from this alone. I think it can only happen together. So I want to encourage people who feel ready to share their story in a public space on social media to use that hashtag and share their story, a brief snippet about it, and then be able to find others who have experienced the same thing. And if people want to find other ways to be able to share their stories that are perhaps a little less public, they can learn more about it at breakfreetogether.org.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Pure. Linda K. Klein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Linda K. Klein is the founder of Break Free Together and the author of Pure, Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. It's published by Touchstone. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.